I just want to welcome everyone to Adopting Multi-Horizon Leadership. It's a third of our three-part series. But these live streams for Maximus is something that we kicked off really in early few days of the COVID response. The first one we ran was in the second or third week of March. And it was a pivot that we made to stay close to the community of leaders that wrap themselves around us. They've not been without their trials. The effort that goes into these live streams is actually quite enormous. There's a lot of thought leadership put into the content. And we've gotten feedback from our community of leaders like yourselves around the timeliness, the relevance, and just the general helpful conversations that we've been having through these weekly rituals. So today's a little bit different. We're joined by a special guest, Mandy Johnson, who'll join us in a moment. But throughout these live streams, one of the key models that we've been really calling upon throughout the live streams is this idea of the three phases. So with the three phases, they've really formed a foundation for us to think about the stages and the phases of something that didn't have a rule book written for it. But as leaders and all the conversations that we're having in market, it's firmly stated and we're all feeling that we're really in that third phase of the re-entry. There's a lot of conversations around re-entry, whether that's an operational conversation, a strategic conversation, operating model conversation. But over the 20 years, one of the things that I've personally learned is that if I feel like I'm immensely immersed in one phase, it means that I really need to lift my gaze. I need to lift my gaze to the future and what's beyond. I heard an amazing quote from one of the senior executives I'm working with in an investment bank, actually. He said, COVID's not the disruptor. It's actually the facilitator of the future. So as leaders, what we want to challenge ourselves tonight is to not get stuck in that third phase, not get stuck in the short term. We can't underestimate the economic headwinds that we're all going to be faced into, but we don't want to be known as leaders who are just coping and reacting. We're no longer naive to a global pandemic. And we've shown enormous amounts of capacity in the last 12 to 13 weeks. Capacity to grow, resilience to dig deep, give more, adaptability to work anywhere, even with kids hanging off us needing homeschooling, but also the humility to listen to experts, to listen to our government. And if any of you are like me, I don't really like to be told what to do, but we had to be told what to do. But at this moment, now's the time for us to stretch. Stretch for the future. It's time to bring foresight.
There are endless lessons on foresight in that video. Some positive examples of when foresight was present and sometimes disastrous consequences when it wasn't. But foresight isn't always on such a grand scale. Our recent experience with COVID highlighted to me the uncertainty of what our future holds. I personally have found it quite challenging to lift my gaze. Early on in the crisis, I was completely immersed in the day-to-day. And focusing on tasks and quite frankly, trying to survive. I couldn't see how I could put the time, energy and focus on the future and saw the crisis as a disruption. I couldn't see the opportunities. When I looked around, I realised that our business had seen the opportunity to reinvent itself and was doing so quickly. I realised I needed to work on building skills to operate in the future. I needed to build my foresight capability. And if I was going to be part of reimagining the future. Foresight is a capability like any other skill, one that we can learn to develop. Perhaps not surprisingly, the Institute for the Future has highlighted, along with commercial and strategic acumen, foresight is the next lacking capability.
I'd love to hear from perhaps someone about what you discussed in terms of your level of foresight that you are currently operating in and also what about the organisation and where you think that sits. So it'd be great to hear from one of the breakout groups what you discussed.
Yes, so we've been using this analogy as a way to kind of certainly for all of our employees to bring everyone on the journey. Sort of talking about performance-wise, heading into 2020 in a really strong position with a clear map of where we were going on a boat that was fit for the purpose that we intended it with a very clear destination in mind. And very suddenly in the middle of March, a really massive storm hit, unforecast and impossible to predict, which came with it high seas and torrential rain and winds and very poor visibility. And the organisation had to very quickly tack and change the direction, pause for a while, take some shelter, redeploy people from, you know, one side of the boat to the other side of the boat and sort of trying to weather that storm, but at the same time, thinking ahead to where we would need to be on the other side of it. So as we came through the storm, what kind of boat we needed to get us to the new destination that we might be heading towards, with the team equipped to make the journey ahead. It's been a really useful analogy to set the scene for where to from here, because it's about getting the boat in shape to get us to the destination that's going to be 2021. Being able to show that at the same time as you had to act very quickly to respond, but you also needed to be having an eye to where you're going to be on the other side of it.
And I love that comment that you made, Lisa, around the opportunity to make it the company that we want. Yeah. A privilege to be able to sit back in a way. Been difficult, but a privilege to sit back and go, I wonder what company we do want. I wonder what we want to be part of. I want, we want to be creating for our customers and communities.
You know, I think we've all had experiencing this opportunity or time to reflect. It's given us that sort of space to think about foresight. But, you know, when we think about what foresight is made up of, it's a skill like any other. And it's, you know, we have the opportunity to perhaps not wait for a crisis to exercise it. At Maximus, we love a model. We're consultants after all. And, you know, what we did was we thought a bit about what foresight was made up of in an attempt to just break it down and work on how to develop foresight for ourselves, but also for our leadership community. So we've just popped up the model here. And essentially, you know, when we look at the foresight model, some of the important elements to think about here are that it's not linear. So, you know, it can be a bit messy at times. It's not actually a step-by-step process. But if we break it down, we can actually kind of work out what things we're exercising and what things we're not and what we need to get better at. So I heard a really interesting example recently that really sort of spoke to the idea that foresight isn't just about perspective and insight. You know, there's a lot of parts to it. One of the law firms that we're working with at the moment, leading law firm in Australia, they actually let us know recently that they had anticipated the financial sector Royal Commission 5 years prior to it actually being announced. And this organisation attempted to alert or educate its clients about it, but they just couldn't get their clients to act. They weren't able to activate the change that they could foresee. And so when we look at this model, the elements of it, bringing those elements together is really important. So, you know, not only do we need to have a level of commitment and carve out that time, like I talked about earlier, the time and space, you know, don't get bogged down in the detail. We also need to think about taking our insights and actually being comfortable to generate new ideas and think about how we can translate those insights into a solution or an idea that can actually be the future for us, for our organisations, and then take that into something quite tangible for us to be able to step forward. But no use doing that if we can't activate the change. And that's the example that I mentioned earlier, was that this organisation, they had the perspective, they actually had some ideas that they were taking to their clients, but they weren't able to activate that. So how do they get the power of the collective to be able to influence the change, to be able to get the value out of foresight? In order to access multi-horizonal leadership and really unlock the opportunities, we need to think about what that might look like for us. And we're joined today by Mandy Johnson. So Mandy is going to answer a few questions for us. She's going to share some of her experiences and help us get some value out of those insights. So Mandy Johnson was actually the co-founder of Flight Centre in the UK, their operations. And she's also the course director for the owner course management course at the University of Queensland. And she's also an author of two renowned books that have been bestsellers. So welcome today, Mandy. Mandy, it's lovely to have you here. So Mandy, what examples can you share with our leadership community today that can give them some tips or ideas on the examples of conditions for foresight?
Look, I think there's probably three things that I learned going over to the UK and starting it up there. The first one, and I was terrible at this when I first went over there, was to have great foresight, you have to take time out for reflection. So if you look at, and I think it's even worse now than when I was starting up, was, you know, we have projects, meetings, emails snowballing, you know, this mobile digital devices that connect us 24/7. There's kind of this corporate expectation that we need to do it all. And the problem for us is that as humans, that's not natural to us. You know, if you think we've been hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years, when we were hunter-gatherers, there were these natural off times, like the end of berry season or the end of buffalo migration. So what we need to do is we need to recreate those kind of downtime so that we get that time out for reflection ourselves, so that we can become sort of thinking human beings rather than mindless human doings. You know, there's some great examples. I know Bill Gates used to have Think Weeks, and he still credits all of Microsoft's best innovations to those Think Weeks where he actually took time completely out of the business. And I know myself, just in the UK, I was such a doer at the start, and my, you know, there was such a direct correlation. By the end, I was taking a huge amount of time out for reflection, and the success of the business was amazing in comparison. So that's the first thing. The second thing I'd say is having courage to put your head above the parapet, and especially to often, if you're fighting conventional ideas. So for instance, for me, I was quite successful in Australia and was probably a bit complacent. And so when I went over to the UK, you know, I was shocked that, you know, 3 months later, I still hadn't got any decent staff, you know, couldn't get good shops. And I realised that, you know, in Australia, Flight Centre was this big fish. We had a shop on every street corner. In the UK, we were this little tiny guppy. I remember I actually got all my management textbooks and I threw them out the window and just went, you know, there was no point doing stuff that I'd done before because it just didn't work in that environment. So I was forced to innovate. I was told I was mad and, you know, crazy ideas. And I didn't go on gut feel. I am very evidence-based. So I trialed and tested stuff for 5 years. But, you know, it was those things that actually made us really, really successful. And, you know, I'm really chuffed that today the UK is the most profitable business for Flight Centre outside of Australia. So that's the second thing. And the final thing is really about moving fast. So you do need time out for reflection, but then you need to come in and be what I call agile, not perfect. So I'm a past perfectionist. I got that beaten out of me in the UK. And there's some great research that backs, you know, why we have to be fast now. So Deloitte did a study of Fortune 500 companies. And in 1950, the lifespan of a Fortune 500 company was 75 years. By 2001, that was 15. And now it's estimated that the average lifespan of any product or service that we offer is 5 to 7 years. So that's a radical change in our lifespan. The other thing that's changed is that if you look at the, you know, in the 20th century, we just got products and then we just sort of slowly tweaked them for years and years and years. And that doesn't work anymore. We really need to be looking for paradigm shifts. So what I mean by that, if you look at movie live streaming, the way it decimated video stores, the product didn't change, just the delivery model did. And so, you know, that's what we're looking at now is more. And technology obviously expedites this, is we have to, you know, use our foresight for that kind of change rather than just tweaking small things slowly and trying to get them perfect, because, you know, you'll get them perfect in 8 years, but hey, your product was only valid for 7.
Can you just give us a few more anecdotes about what that looked like in terms of kind of putting your head above the parapet?
Okay, it was really, I think I was lucky also because I did a journalism degree, so I had no background in business at all. So I think that actually helped because I wasn't sort of blinkered by traditional ideas. But really what I had to do, like just to give you, I'll give you a specific example, okay? So I couldn't get good recruits and, you know, because we had no pull, you know, no one knew us, we were so small. So I realized that like great applicants were like houses. They don't stay on the market for long. So I trialed the following week speed, you know, how about I put an ad in, you know, I interview and da da, and within a week, you know, make an offer. And so what I found, I got 6 great recruits the following week. One of them who's actually the managing director of Flight Centre UK now. It was amazing that when you started doing things opposite, and, you know, that's very opposite to what the thinking was at the time, which was really slow down your recruitment. No, you have to still have great systems, but you have to move fast. So, you know, it was really I trialed and tested, you know, even just the words and ads and how we got our leaders up to speed. We were opening a shop a month, so we had to make people leaders within about 6 months. So how do you fast track that kind of performance to get people up to speed and autonomy? you know, I started hiring for attitude. So I hired archaeologists and post office managers and teachers and all sorts of, I never hired a travel agent. And it was amazing how that worked, because that diversity, just they all brought innovation with them that, you know, if I just hired for technical skills, I would never have got.
I mean, one of the models that we've been using to really search for the opportunities during the current crisis is the model of the three R's. So we've talked about it a number of these live streams around, and I think what you talked about is evidence of that. So when you went over to the UK, what did you want to repatriate and take with you that might fit over there? But what did you need to adjust and retrofit? But also, what did you want to reimagine? So really, what was it that you weren't going to copy, that you were going to differentiate and you were going to do differently? This idea of, and we've used this model through these live streams, but if you overlay these models on top of something that many of you have seen before, the multi-horizon model from McKinsey. So David and I, we were just talking about this in the breakout earlier, the importance of having a multi-horizon view. And if you overlay the repatriation, the retrofit and the reimagination over these, it gets you to look at your business as a truly ambidextrous organization. So what do you need to be doing with the core business? What goes beyond the core that may there be tweaks or innovation in the adjacencies? But then the final horizon is the breakthrough opportunities. And whenever we've looked at this model before, one of the things to really keep front of mind is this is not a time-based model. So it's not about sitting in the first horizon, then steadily moving to the second and then moving to the third. It's not a time-bound exercise. It's about the underpinning, which we've got here, which is the underpinning of the true north of your organization. So the true north in different terms might be your organizational purpose. It might be the vision. It might be just as simply as how you state the job to be done. And what we need to do as ambidextrous organizations and leaders is actually find the time and the space and the energy to actually live in all three horizons as we move through. I took a step back and thought about what has COVID provided? And COVID has provided examples of definitely innovations in the adjacencies, but also in the breakthrough opportunities. So two that I picked out, so I don't know if anyone's done what I've done, which is go through the McDonald's drive-thru to get bread, milk or eggs. So an adjacency that they quickly helped with society. But the other one that I found really inspiring was Mattel, who actually used it as an opportunity to release a new range of toys, a new range of superheroes. And the superheroes are nurses, doctors, teachers. So there's organizations that have taken the opportunity during COVID to really look at their adjacencies and the breakthroughs. Again, if you look at this multi-horizon model and take a step back, some of the organizations that have really shone and I guess really shown up from a strategic and an sort of an outcomes perspective, if you take a step back, you can look at an organization like Amazon. So if you look at what Bezos originally tried to do, and he set up in his organization in the 90s when he borrowed $250,000 from his mum and dad, it was pretty simple at the beginning. It was an internet shopfront with low-cost products like books. But whilst he was building that business, he was also living in the second horizon where he was testing a completely new business model, which we all now know was the marketplace model, where he opened up the platform to other small businesses to sit on his platform and to trade. Again, also whilst doing that was looking at his third horizon. And his third horizon is again what we all now call the partnership model, where he created these mammoth partnerships and launched ventures like the web services business and the TV. So if you take a step back from Amazon, it truly is a multi-horizon organization. It's no surprise that it was the second organization in the US to become a trillion-dollar business. But one of the most important factors to think about when you think about Amazon across these three horizons is the North Star down the bottom. And one of the things that's remained unchanged across each of those horizons is the claim that Amazon, they state that we aim to be the Earth's most customer-centric company. We've got your hat on now for foresight. We've thought about these three horizons. What are the opportunities across your organizations that sit potentially in that adjacency or horizon two?
We were talking about the idea that refugees are a cost in a country and that that's the result of really quite short-term thinking. Refugees arrive in a country, you have to pay to vaccinate them, to feed them, to house them. And many countries, refugees largely arrive in the poorest countries on earth next door, of course. One example is in Bangladesh, where there's 1.2 million Rohingya have arrived over the last few years. It's a massive cost to Bangladesh because the Rohingya are housed, they're in camps, they're not allowed to work. They simply have to be fed, vaccinated, and looked after. And government of Bangladesh is starting to think quite seriously about this at the moment, because there's 300 children being born every day in the camp. And they've started to have to think, what are these children going to be doing when they're 18? Are they going to be Bangladeshi, or are they going to be Rohingya? Are they going to work? Are they going to be Islamic? Are they going to be radicalized? I mean, a whole load of really interesting things. But at the moment, they just have got to think about the very short term. The example I used, which I think is contrary to that, is in the north of Uganda, there are refugee camps there that are being populated by the South Sudanese diaspora coming out of South Sudan. Now, when you come into Uganda from South Sudan, you get a work permit, somewhere to live, and a bit of money. It's really far-sighted, because the community in the north of Uganda, as a result, is actually a net taxpayer. It's not costing Uganda a cent. It's actually earning them money. And people are moving from Kampala up to the north because of the economic environment that is being created by the refugee community. It's not a business. It's a different kind of a world. But it made me think, this is the result of contrasting the very short-term thinking. People have arrived, you know, in Bangladesh, it's hundreds and hundreds a day coming across the river from Myanmar. We've got to feed them, we've got to vaccinate them, we've got to house them. The short-term problem is right in front of me. But I also have to think about what these people are going to be doing in 18, 20 years' time, compared with the more long-term view of Uganda, which is, these people are never going home, most likely. We're going to create an economic community of them. So I haven't put that very well, but you understand what I'm talking about.
That's great. I think from the chat, really resonating with people in terms of long-term impact. And I think this is a really good example of foresight. So, you know, it's about working out what sits in those different horizons and where are the opportunities to bring, you know, some of the thinking forward and being agile with the way that we think about those problems that sit in front of us. So to close out the session today, we really want to share with you a few practical examples about how we can build up the muscle of foresight. So, you know, what is it that we can do to be able to develop it? And after today's session, we're going to send you a toolkit with some of this information. So firstly, commit the time to live in the future. So recognize the value of living in the future and put the discipline around making that happen. Be curious about the signals around you. So notice those signals. Kind of really get comfortable in recognizing the signals. I think courage is really important when we start talking about foresight as well, because for a lot of us, it might mean that we have to operate in a different area of expertise. So, you know, it might be about being more creative than we normally think that we need to be. You know, so as a leader, we may not see ourselves as creative. It might be about building out the plays, yeah, the specific tangible steps, and really bringing courage to the conviction with which we present those to others. And then finally, how do we inspire the collective to activate that future right now? So what are the inspirational qualities that are required to be able to really get the value out of the foresight that we have? To close out today's session, which is the final one in a live stream series of three, I'd like to leave you with a final thought. So let's all be the leaders and that seeded the hope and created the future. And the most reliable way to do that is to create it.